A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. In the last episode about ADHD medications, we talked about the process of dose adjustments. And of course, without offering anyone personal medical advice, talking about, you know, approximate factors for how the brain reacts when you're titrating up or down on a stimulant med. Because as I mentioned, these medications are often viewed by clinicians as, well, it's super easy, you know, Vyvanse, it's easy, it's a stimulant. It's not like an SSRI where there, if you go down too quickly, you might get, you know, brain zaps and become emotionally, have a relapse of depression, which could be extremely dangerous. I think most clinicians tend to see it as one of the more benign withdrawal syndromes, and often tell patients, yeah, just do like a 2-day titration, or, you know, 2-day taper, you'll be fine. And day one, you're lying there in bed trying to summon up the energy to get a glass of water and feeling like, wait, this is a lot harder than what I expected. Anyway, Herman and Corin, one of the reasons I asked that question was to talk about both sides of the picture, going up in medication and going down. And I mentioned, especially for those who've been treated for successfully with stimulants for a while, sometimes you actually find you can let up a bit on the dose and come down. One of the reasons why people would do that is something called hyperfocus, which is what I'd love to talk about in today's episode. It's the forgotten side of the focus picture, in my opinion. The side everyone sees and treats and knows is someone who can't focus. And I guess, especially if you've been untreated for your ADHD for most of your life, as I was, I only began treatment in my 30s. Before that, just pounded coffee like it was my religious identity. And I guess you can kind of say, well, I need more. This is great. And, you know, then there's this kind of process by which you learn that the medication is powerful and you learn to trust it, that you don't necessarily need as high of a dose as maybe you think. And a good clinician will push back and make sure that the dose increases are conservative. But sometimes, and I don't know, maybe there's different mechanics for this. It could be body weight, lead. And this is something I'd actually love to know. If someone loses weight while they're being treated with a drug like Vyvanse or Ritalin, the same drug that they had on a larger body size is going to affect them more potently than after they've lost weight. But other factors as well. Maybe you've just found that you're hyper-focusing. And again, that's what I'd love to talk about here. So let's discuss the subtle problems that can occur when somebody's on too high of a dose of a stimulant medication. What are some signs of when healthy focus, the kind of focus that helps people to be productive at work and in life, has veered into what's often called hyperfocus? The best definition that I've heard of hyperfocus, or the best description, was something like its rigidity, which maps very well onto what I experienced when I was trying the first of these drugs. It's kind of like, you, when we're talking about what isn't the ideal state of focus, it's not so scattered, or, you know, that you're kind of jumping around all over the place, but there is a point at which you have to normally be able to detach from one task, switch context, and resume another, which I think for people with ADHD, where executive dysfunction is often very pronounced and the very task of context switching sounds scary. Certainly I'm feeling that way as I talk about it. That can seem like a steep ask. And maybe people have, this is something I'd also like to talk about. I feel like a lot of ADHD patients have had such unpleasant experiences dealing with insurance, doctors, and bureaucracy in general, that there is a fear that if if you're taking, let's say, 50 milligrams of Vyvanse, and you decide in consultation with your doctor to go down to 40, that you'll never be able to go back up if you say, well, no, actually, this wasn't quite enough. Let's go back to 50 milligrams. That you've kind of lost your access. Is that a thing that people encounter? I can't say I've ever done a downward upward thing, but certainly if you ask me what's my personal hesitation, those kind of fears lurk in the background from just generally seeing how temperamental things like insurance and bureaucracy can be, especially with ADHD. Herman and Korn, over to you.
Last week, we talked about the titration tightrope, going up, going down, finding the dose that works. But here's the thing. Everyone talks about focus as the goal. Nobody talks about what happens when focus becomes the problem.
When you're so locked in, you can't stop. When 3 hours pass and you haven't moved, haven't eaten, haven't even noticed someone said your name.
The forgotten side of the focus picture. Hyperfocus isn't a superpower. It's rigidity wearing a productivity costume.
This matters right now because more adults are getting diagnosed later in life, finally getting treated, and the instinct is always more. More focus, more productivity, more medication. But the risk of overcorrection is real, and it's almost never discussed in the prescribing conversation.
Daniel sent us this one, and he's asking specifically about that overcorrection. What are the signs that healthy focus has tipped into hyperfocus? What actually happens in the brain when you're on too high a dose? And then there's the part nobody talks about, the fear of losing access entirely if you try to adjust downward.
Which is a legitimate fear, by the way. We'll get into that. But let's start with the experience itself. What hyperfocus actually feels like, why it happens, and why it's so easy to mistake for the thing you wanted all along. To start, let's define the thing. Hyperfocus in the clinical sense isn't just deep concentration, it's an inability to disengage. You're locked onto one task and you cannot pull away, even when context demands it.
Context always demands it eventually. Someone needs you. Something's burning. Your body is sending signals you're ignoring.
There's a paper from 2023 in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry that found about 30% of adults with ADHD reported hyperfocus as a negative symptom when they were overmedicated. But here's what's strange. It's not in the DSM. It's not formally recognized as a diagnostic criterion or a treatment side effect.
Which means clinicians aren't trained to ask about it. The screening questionnaire doesn't have a box for, do you sometimes lose entire afternoons to a single spreadsheet cell and then realize you missed two meetings and forgot to eat?
The patient might not even flag it as a problem, because for someone who spent decades unable to focus at all, being able to lock in feels like winning. It feels like the medication is working.
That's the trap. The thing you wanted most shows up wearing the wrong clothes, and you don't recognize it until you've missed your third deadline, and your spouse is asking why you're irritable every time they interrupt you.
I want to pause on that for a second, the spouse noticing before you do, because that's actually one of the most reliable external signals. The person who lives with you sees the pattern before you see it yourself. They notice you haven't gotten up from that chair in 4 hours. They notice the sharpness in your voice when they ask if you want dinner. But here's the problem. The patient often dismisses that feedback because they feel productive.
You don't understand. I'm finally getting things done.
And the partner backs off because they don't want to be the person complaining about their spouse finally functioning. It takes an average of several months, sometimes longer, before the patient themselves recognizes that the productivity is coming at a cost.
There's this lag between when the hyperfocus starts causing damage and when the person experiencing it can see the damage. The partner's living in the reality. The patient's living in the dopamine.
That lag is where relationships get strained, jobs get lost, health gets neglected. By the time the patient notices, there's often a pile of consequences already accumulated.
That's the best word for it. Healthy focus is flexible. You can hold attention on something, but you can also shift when needed. Pathological hyperfocus is brittle. You're not choosing to stay on the task. You're stuck there.
Think of it like a car with a stuck accelerator. The engine's running great, you're moving forward, but you can't steer and you can't brake. From the outside, you're still a moving vehicle. From the inside, you're terrified because you've lost control.
The withdrawal piece Daniel mentioned. The reason clinicians treat it as trivial when patients say coming down is brutal. That's connected to this same rigidity dynamic. When your dopamine system has been locked into overdrive all day, the crash isn't just tiredness. It's a functional deficit.
Dopamine receptor downregulation. Your brain adapts to the high signal by reducing receptor sensitivity. So when the medication wears off, you're not returning to baseline. You're dropping below it. For a day, sometimes two, sometimes longer.
Here's where I want to push on something. You said the brain adapts. How quickly does that adaptation happen? Are we talking weeks? Months?
It depends on the dose and the duration, but receptor downregulation can begin within days of consistently elevated dopamine signaling. The brain is astonishingly fast at trying to maintain homeostasis. Within a couple of weeks, at a dose that's too high, you've already got measurable changes in receptor sensitivity.
Someone who's been on the same high dose for 2 years? Their baseline, when the medication wears off, is substantially lower than their pre-medication baseline.
And that's the cruel irony. They started medication to lift their baseline, and the overcorrection has pushed their unmedicated baseline even lower than where they started. They're more dependent on the medication than they were at the beginning, not because they're addicted, but because their neurochemistry has adapted around an artificially high signal.
Which brings us to the central question. How do you know when you've crossed the line? When is focus actually hyperfocus? And what are the signals you're missing?
The answer starts with what's actually happening in the brain, because the mechanics explain why hyperfocus feels so deceptive. Stimulants increase dopamine signaling in the prefrontal cortex. That's the part that handles executive function, task prioritization, working memory. When you get that right, the signal-to-noise ratio improves. You can filter out distractions and hold a line of thought.
When you get it wrong, the filter becomes a wall.
Too much dopamine in the prefrontal cortex narrows your attentional scope. You lose cognitive flexibility, the ability to notice that context has changed and you need to shift. The task in front of you becomes the only thing your brain can see.
It's not that you're choosing to keep going. The exit door is literally not visible to you.
And this maps onto something called the inverted U-dose response curve for dopamine agonists. It's well documented in cognitive neuroscience. Too little dopamine and you can't focus at all. The sweet spot gives you flexible, adaptive attention. Too much and you lock into rigid, perseverative behavior. You get stuck.
The inverted U. So the dose that makes someone functional and the dose that makes someone a statue are closer than people think.
And here's where it gets tricky. Hyperfocus feels productive while it's happening. Your brain is flooded with task-relevant dopamine. You're making progress on something, and that feels rewarding. The problem is you're making progress on the wrong scale. You're optimizing a function while your life burns around you.
Like the programmer who spends 8 hours refactoring a single function and misses 3 meetings. At the end of the day, they feel accomplished. They solve the hard technical problem. But they actually failed at their job that day.
Or the writer who produces 5,000 words, can't stop to eat lunch, and crashes at 3 p.m. with a migraine and a blood sugar level that would concern a physician. The output was real, but the cost was everything else.
I want to add a third example because I think it's the most insidious one. The parent who spends an entire Saturday organizing the garage. Bins labeled, shelves installed, everything perfect, while their kid is inside watching TV alone for 6 hours. At the end of the day, the garage looks amazing. The parent feels like they accomplished something tangible, but they missed an entire day with their child.
That's the one that keeps me up. Because the garage organizer isn't being lazy or neglectful in the traditional sense. They're working hard. They're being productive. But the hyperfocus has stolen their ability to notice what actually matters in that moment.
The guilt spiral that follows. You realize at 8 p.m. that you barely spoke to your kid all day, and you can't even explain why you couldn't stop. I was organizing the garage. Sounds absurd when you say it out loud, but in the moment it felt like the most important thing in the world.
That's the dopamine narrowing. Your brain assigned monumental importance to the task in front of you and zero importance to everything else. It's not a character flaw, it's a neurochemical hijacking.
The irritability piece. When someone interrupts you in that state, it's not mild annoyance, it's rage.
Because your brain has to tear itself away from a dopamine stream it's been locked onto for hours. The interruption isn't just an interruption, It's a chemical disruption. Your brain treats it almost like a threat. That's why people snap at spouses or coworkers and then feel confused about why they reacted so strongly.
I've heard people describe it as feeling physically painful to be pulled away, like someone yanking a cord out of a socket.
That's not far from what's happening neurologically. The anterior cingulate cortex, which monitors for errors and conflicts, lights up when you're forced to switch tasks against your brain's current priority. On a high dopamine state, that conflict signal gets amplified. What would normally be mild frustration registers as genuine distress.
The signs are, you lose track of time for hours on a single task. You can't interrupt yourself for basic needs. Hunger, bathroom, someone saying your name, and you get disproportionately angry when pulled away. That's not focus. That's being trapped.
Those are the signs patients almost never report because they don't recognize them as side effects. They think that's what productivity feels like.
Until the crash. Which brings us to the other half of this. What happens when the dose wears off?
The withdrawal asymmetry. When you've been on a dose that's too high, your brain adapts by downregulating dopamine receptors. It's trying to maintain homeostasis against a flood of signal. So when the medication clears, you're not dropping back to your normal baseline. You're dropping below it. The receptors that would normally pick up endogenous dopamine are less sensitive now.
You're worse off than before you took anything.
Functionally, yes, for a period. That's why the crash from a too high dose feels so brutal. It's not just tiredness. It's a genuine dopamine deficit. You can't summon motivation. You can't initiate tasks. Everything feels effortful. And clinicians who've never experienced it tend to underestimate how long that lasts.
The two-day taper thing Daniel mentioned. Day one, you're lying in bed trying to summon energy to get a glass of water.
That's not weakness or dependency. That's neurochemistry. Your brain needs time to upregulate those receptors again. A two-day taper doesn't give it nearly enough runway, especially if you've been at a high dose for months or years.
Can we talk about what upregulation actually requires? Because I think people hear your brain will adjust, and imagine it's like waiting out a headache.
Receptor upregulation is slow. We're talking about your neurons physically rebuilding receptor proteins on their surfaces. That process takes time, weeks, not days. And during that time, your endogenous dopamine, which you're still producing, has fewer receptors to bind to. It's like having a perfectly good radio signal, but your antenna is damaged. The signal's there, you just can't receive it.
The very thing that's supposed to help you function leaves you unable to function when it leaves your system. And the higher the dose, the harder the fall.
Which creates this perverse cycle. Patient feels the crash, thinks the medication is the only thing keeping them functional, and becomes even more reluctant to reduce the dose, even when the dose is causing the crash in the first place.
The cure becomes the cause, and you can't see it because you're inside it.
That's the inverted U playing out in real life. The sweet spot isn't just about focus during the day, it's about stability across the whole cycle. When you're at the right dose, the offset should be gradual, manageable. When you're too high, the offset feels like falling off a cliff.
I think this is where a lot of people get stuck conceptually. They think, if the crash is bad, I need more medication to smooth it out. When actually, the crash is bad because there's too much medication in the first place.
That's the counterintuitive piece that's so hard to communicate. Reducing the dose often reduces the crash, but when you're in it, every instinct says the opposite. Your brain is screaming for more dopamine, and the thing that provides dopamine is the pill. The logic feels inescapable.
It's like drinking more coffee because you're jittery from too much coffee.
And just like caffeine, you can end up in a spiral where you're treating the side effects of the drug with more of the drug. The only way out is to step back and reduce, but stepping back means enduring a period of feeling worse before you feel better. That cliff is exactly what makes the next layer so tricky. We've talked about what hyperfocus feels like and why it happens, but there's another dimension to dose adjustments, the fear of losing access entirely.
The bureaucratic terror. You finally got the thing that works. The system made you fight for it. And now you're supposed to voluntarily say, actually, less please.
It's not irrational. There's something specific that makes this worse that most people don't think about. Body weight. If you lose weight while on a fixed dose of Vyvanse or Ritalin, the same milligram amount becomes effectively more potent. Smaller body mass, same drug load, stronger effect.
Someone drops 15 pounds over 6 months. Maybe the medication suppressed their appetite. Maybe they started exercising, and their 50 milligrams of Vyvanse is now hitting like 60.
They might not connect the dots. They just know they feel overstimulated, they're hyper-focusing more, the crash is worse. But the dose hasn't changed on paper, so nobody flags it.
Does the prescribing guidance account for this?
Most dosing guidelines are weight-based for children, but not for adults. Once you're past 18, it's treated as one-size-fits-all with adjustments based on reported symptoms. A patient who loses significant weight on a stimulant is rarely told. We may need to recalculate your dose.
The patient is effectively on a higher dose than prescribed, and neither they nor their doctor realizes it.
Even when they do realize it, here's where the fear kicks in. The prompt mentioned this, the anxiety that if you go from 50 milligrams down to 40, you'll never be able to go back up. That if you try a reduction and it doesn't work, you've lost your access permanently.
Is that fear rational or paranoid?
It's rational with a side of paranoia, and the paranoia exists because the system has earned it. Let me walk through the actual mechanics. When you want to go up in dose, the doctor writes a new prescription. Maybe there's a prior authorization, but it's usually straightforward. You're increasing, not starting something new. Going down and then back up is a completely different beast, because going down means a new prescription at a lower dose. That's a new prior authorization. If you then need to go back up 6 months later, that's another new prescription, another new prior authorization. Each one is a fresh review by the insurance company. Each one can be denied. Each one can trigger a gap in coverage where you're without medication.
Going up is one bureaucratic step. Going down and back up is three.
And each step introduces a failure point. The pharmacy might not have the new dose in stock. We've been living with stimulant shortages for years now. The prior authorization might sit on someone's desk for a week. Your doctor might be on vacation when the request comes through. Any one of these and you're suddenly unmedicated.
Which for someone who depends on this to function is not a minor inconvenience. It's a crisis.
Here's the psychological trap. You finally found a medication that works. After years of struggling, maybe decades undiagnosed, you have something that lets you function. The thought of touching that, of voluntarily disrupting it, feels like madness, even if the dose is clearly too high.
Because a dose that's too high is still a dose that works. It's just working wrong.
Working wrong is better than not working at all. That's the calculus patients are doing in their heads. The hyperfocus is damaging their life, the crash is brutal, but the alternative is the abyss of untreated ADHD that they remember all too well.
I've heard people describe it as being a hostage to their own prescription. They know the dose isn't right, but they can't risk losing it.
There's a specific case that illustrates this perfectly. Patient loses 15 pounds over 6 months. The appetite suppression from the medication itself often causes this. Their 50 milligram Vyvanse is now effectively 60. They're experiencing all the hyperfocus signs we talked about. They bring it up with their doctor, and the doctor says, stay the course. Not because it's medically optimal, but because the paperwork to adjust the dose is too much hassle.
The doctor is optimizing for administrative convenience over patient outcomes.
The doctor might not even be wrong, from a systems perspective. They know that a dose change means prior authorization, means phone calls with insurance, means the patient might show up at the pharmacy and be told the medication isn't covered. The system punishes adjustment.
The patient stays stuck. 50 milligrams, hyperfocusing, crashing, irritable, because the alternative is a bureaucratic gauntlet.
Then there's the other case. The patient who actually goes through with it, tapers down from 50 to 40, feels better. The hyperfocus eases, the crash is gentler, they can eat lunch again. 6 months later, life stress hits, new job, family crisis, whatever, and they need to go back up to 50. They've been there before, they know it works. The doctor agrees, writes the script.
The pharmacy says no.
Prior authorization denied. Or the system shows the patient was stable on 40, so why the increase? Maybe it flags as dose escalation, which triggers a review for abuse potential. The patient who responsibly tapered down is now being treated like they're drug-seeking from wanting to return to a dose they were previously prescribed for years.
That's Kafkaesque. You're being punished for having been responsible.
It's not hypothetical. The fear of exactly this scenario is what keeps people on doses they know are too high. They've heard stories from support groups, from Reddit threads, from friends who went through it. The system treats stimulant prescriptions as static. Find your dose and stay there forever. But human lives are dynamic.
There's also the labeling fear. If you ask to reduce your dose, does that get noted somewhere as patient-requested dose reduction? And then later, if you need an increase, does that look like escalation or instability?
The non-compliant or drug-seeking flags. Most patients don't know what's in their file, but they know those categories exist. A dose reduction request could be interpreted as the medication not being tolerated well, which might make a future increase look like you're pushing for something you previously rejected. It's paranoid thinking, except the system has demonstrated repeatedly that it is not your friend.
Can we talk about what drug seeking actually means in a medical record and how it functions?
It's a note that can follow you between providers, between pharmacies, between health systems. Once that flag is in your chart, every future interaction is filtered through suspicion. You ask for a dose adjustment, and the doctor's first thought isn't. This patient is collaborating on their treatment. It's this patient is angling for more medication.
There's no due process. You don't get notified that you've been flagged. You don't get to contest it. You just notice, over time, that your requests are met with resistance you can't explain.
The threshold for getting flagged is disturbingly low. Asking for an early refill because you're going on vacation, requesting a dose adjustment more than once in a year, switching providers, and asking for your previous prescription. All of these are normal, legitimate patient behaviors that can trigger a drug-seeking note in the wrong system.
The fear of losing access isn't just about the immediate prescription. It's about a permanent mark that changes how every future provider sees you.
That's the stakes patients are weighing. Not just will this dose adjustment work, but could this attempt to optimize my treatment brand me for years?
How common is this? Being stuck on a dose you know is too high?
Hard to get hard numbers because it's not something people report formally. But anecdotally, in ADHD communities, it's one of the most common frustrations. People describe it as white knuckling, their dose. They know the side effects are too much. They know the hyperfocus is costing them, but the thought of navigating the system to adjust is more daunting than just enduring it.
Enduring a known bad over risking an unknown worse.
That's the asymmetry. Going up is easy. The doctor writes a script. You're seeking more focus. The system is built for that. Going down and then back up is a bureaucratic nightmare that can leave you without medication for weeks. So people stay where they are, hyper-focusing and crashing, because the cure has become its own kind of trap. If you're listening and thinking, that sounds like me, what do you actually do about it? How do you know if you're in hyper-focused territory versus just being productively focused?
The question of self-assessment. Because you can't fix what you don't name.
The simplest tool is a context switching log. Not a journal, not a feelings diary, just a record of failures to disengage. Skipped meals when you were hungry. Someone asked you to stop and you couldn't. Track it for a week.
The bathroom test. If you've needed to go for 2 hours and you're still sitting there, that's not focus. That's being trapped.
The log gives you data instead of vibes. You bring that to your doctor and say, I'm experiencing rigidity in my focus, not flexibility. That language matters. Rigidity is clinical, it's precise, and it's a side effect they can't dismiss as, well, the medication is working.
Because they hear, I'm too focused, and think, congratulations, problem solved.
You need to reframe it as impairment. I can't context switch when my job demands it. I'm missing obligations. I'm irritable when interrupted. Those are functional deficits, not success stories.
I want to add one more thing to that list, because I think it's the one patients are most reluctant to mention. The emotional numbness. When you're locked into hyperfocus, you're not just ignoring your body, you're ignoring the people around you. And they feel it. Your partner talks to you and gets a monosyllabic response. Your kid shows you a drawing and you glance at it for half a second. You're not present. You're a machine executing a task.
That's the cost that doesn't show up on any clinical questionnaire. The relationship erosion. The slow accumulation of moments where you weren't really there. Your partner stops trying to connect during your focused hours, then stops trying at all. The medication was supposed to help you show up for your life, and instead you're missing it in high definition.
When you're keeping that context switching log, include the social failures too. The conversations you don't remember having, the bids for connection you brushed off, that's data.
What about the taper itself? The two-day thing Daniel described, lying in bed summoning energy for water, that's the standard protocol.
It's insufficient. A gradual reduction over 4 to 6 weeks is far more humane. The brain needs time to upregulate dopamine receptors. Dropping 20 milligrams overnight and white-knuckling through 2 days of crash doesn't tell you anything useful about whether the lower dose works. It just tells you withdrawal feels terrible.
The standard protocol is designed to confirm that reducing the dose was a mistake.
When you ask about a taper schedule, ask for weekly step-downs, 10 milligrams at a time, maybe 5 if you're sensitive, and crucially, ask about the contingency plan. If I go down to 40 and after 4 weeks it's clearly not enough, what's the process for going back to 50? Get that documented.
The backup plan.
Request a written treatment plan that explicitly documents the dose range you're authorized to use, 40 to 50 milligrams, with conditions for adjusting within that range. If it's in your chart as an approved range, insurance has a harder time denying a return to a previously approved dose.
You're not asking for a one-time reduction. You're asking for a documented therapeutic range.
Which is how most other chronic conditions are managed anyway. Nobody tells a diabetic pick one insulin dose and never adjust. Dynamic dosing should be the norm, but the bureaucracy treats stimulants like a fixed switch. Get the flexibility in writing. Which brings me to a question I keep coming back to.
Is hyperfocus a feature or a bug of stimulant treatment?
I think the honest answer is it depends on your life context. If you're a novelist on a deadline, hyperfocus for 8 hours might be exactly what you need. If you're a parent who needs to pick up a kid from school at 3, it's a disaster.
Same brain state, completely different outcome. The medication doesn't know what your life demands.
That's the thing we don't talk about enough. The dose that works for you this year might not be the dose that works for you next year. Life changes, body changes, demands change, but the prescription model is built for stasis.
I think there's also a cultural layer here. We live in a society that valorizes focus. Deep work, flow state, in the zone, these are all framed as aspirational states. So when a patient experiences hyperfocus, they've been culturally trained to see it as achievement, not pathology. The language we have for talking about too much focus is almost non-existent.
We have dozens of words for distraction, for inability to focus. We have almost no vocabulary for the opposite problem. Hyperfocus itself isn't even a formal clinical term. It's a colloquialism that snuck into the conversation because patients needed a word for their experience, and the medical establishment hadn't provided one.
When the culture doesn't give you language for a problem, you can't see it as a problem. You just feel vaguely that something's wrong, but you can't articulate what. It takes someone else saying, "That's not normal," before you even realize you've been suffering.
As more adults get diagnosed later in life, this problem scales. You've got people in their 30s, 40s, 50s starting treatment, and they're navigating careers, families, all the context-switching demands of adult life. The system needs to accommodate dynamic dosing, not static prescriptions.
Right now it doesn't. The bureaucracy treats your dose like a permanent setting, not a range you operate within. Until that changes, patients are going to keep white-knuckling doses that aren't right for them.
Next episode, we're going to flip the lens entirely. We've been talking about stimulants. What about the people for whom stimulants aren't the answer? Non-stimulant options, why they're often dismissed, and why they might actually be a better fit for some patients.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, beekeepers on the Isle of Lewis imported Italian honeybees to boost honey production. The Italian bees' waggle dance used a different dialect than the native black bees. Same dance language, different regional tempo, and the resulting hybrid colonies spent more time misinterpreting each other's directions than actually finding flowers.
The bees invented diplomatic friction. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps. We'll be back next week with non-stimulant options and why they deserve more attention than they get. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you then.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.